Reset Rebel. It's the Reset Rebel. It's the Reset Rebel. It's the Reset Rebel. Coming to you every day.
Welcome back to the Reset Rebel podcast with me, Jo Yule, and for the third and final installment of our trilogy of interviews for the Ray of Light radio show here on Open Lab. And today I'm joined by someone whose story is woven deeply into the island's underground music scene, Nima Gorji. Born in Iran and raised through music, movement and migration, Nima's journey has taken him from early dance floors and record shops to becoming one of the most respected names in house and minimal music. And with a long-standing connection to Ibiza, where he's lived, played and produced for almost 20 years, he's helped shape the sound of countless nights over the years. Nima Gorji, welcome to the Reset Rebel and to Open Lab.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for inviting me.
No, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for making the time. Thank you. Believe you're in Geneva right now. What's happening over there?
Yeah, I'm here to. I have a gig tonight playing at the club called Vitamix. It's one of the most legendary clubs of Geneva, Switzerland. I was invited for this very special party tonight.
Incredible. I mean, you obviously must travel a lot doing what you do. I mean, Ibiza is like a great place to use as a springboard for that.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's I've been living there since 20-something years plus. It's been very much in and out. I'm traveling pretty much all over the world. Yeah, it depends on the year. Sometimes, you know, it's up and downs. Of course, it's as any other careers.
Yeah,
it's been a journey. Definitely.
Of course. I mean, you're playing at the after show party, which is why we've we're having this conversation today of the Ray of Light, which is, of course, starting on the 25th of May. And we're very, very, very excited to enter our second year of the event. And it's shaping up to be an enormously exciting ending to that week-long event, really. And I can't say too much now about the lineup for that, but the tickets are available for the event on the rayoflightawards.com website. So we've got some big stars joining you, I think, for that final after-show party on the lineup, both from the island and beyond. But I wonder if we could just sort of start with how music entered your life when you were growing up, I assume, in Iran.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up with my dad being a musician, and he was a guitar player, and he had a band. And all my life, basically, I was with him in the music rehearsals and in the rooms, studio rooms, and also in his concerts. I mean, when he was doing, when he was with the band out and the concert, me from 6 months, I was with my mom, you know, behind the backstage and watching the concert from behind. Yeah, I got into music very naturally and learned how to play piano and guitars and until. Until my teenage, I started to be interested in electronic music and my first keyboard and synthesizers and started to make beats and some weird sounds. Yeah.
Amazing.
That's been going on, yeah.
I mean, well, how would you describe the music scene of Iran as a source of, you know, perhaps inspiration and obviously, you know, the place that kind of formed your music palette when you were growing up?
Yeah, but I was, I mean, you have to remember, I was living there until I was maybe 13 years old, and it was basically the occupation started, so it was everything was forbidden suddenly. And so what I remember mostly from the music side of my life in Iran was basically from before the revolution or occupation, I call it more, started, yeah, until I was a very, very child. And yeah, but music has always been in my life somehow, so from my dad, my family, and a lot of parties always been. I mean, I remember a lot of parents went to a lot of house parties in different places, you know, so it was always music there, and not especially so much, let's say, Iranian or Persian music. It's mostly because what he was playing also, it was mostly Western music, let's say. Some Persian music, of course. Was in his repertoire, connected with drums and beats from the early age, you know.
Do you think when something's forbidden like that in, you know, a place like that? I mean, obviously we had the Franco times here, which is kind of when the scene, you know, the music scene started in Ibiza. And I think somehow, you know, that kind of restriction or prohibition of something actually developing makes it all that more alluring in many ways.
I don't know actually so much about the Franco time, how much music was forbidden. It was definitely this dictatorship, the Islamic dictatorship took over our country. It was definitely one of their main goals to stop all the everything it was about music and dancing and about enjoyment, basically. But, I mean, during the years, I think, because I haven't been there since 40 years, so I don't know, I only heard from people say, no, but people broke that barrier and started to do underground stuff. And I hear a lot of underground music going on in Iran. A lot of artists, I see their names, and they've, some of them follow me, and some of them contacted me, and so there is an electronic music scene now in Iran, which is very underground. It's not really something that is open, let's say, to the public in a way. You have to know them. You know when you know, you know.
It's a bit like when I went to Saudi Arabia, you know, not so long ago, like a year ago. And I really thought, you know, that this was going to be the kind of experience where, you know, nobody's drinking, nobody's partying, nobody's getting up to mischief. And actually, there's very much, you know, an underground scene there as well, which, I mean, I certainly did not partake in because I was too anxious of doing anything that was potentially going to get me arrested. But, you know, it's fascinating to see when something's, you know, completely restricted in that way, that it obviously, it's still there. It's always going to have that underground.
Yeah, it's difficult. It's very difficult to forbid this kind of thing. I mean, of course, they are following the rest of the world and they see what's happening everywhere. You cannot really, and this is not at all a part of our culture neither. I mean, if you ask an Iranian, I mean, the culture of the Iranian culture is really, music is a huge part of it. So music has always been a huge part of our lives, you know. And before this horrible occupation that came upon us, so it's been a disaster because they try to kill the culture, generally all cultures, like it's all about not having let's say music, not having dancing, not dress up properly, it's all about being this I call it dark ages, you know. They put the dark age all over our country, you know, and all upon the people. So to control, basically, is to control. This is the way they can control everything.
Do you think, what do you think that the purpose behind that control is, though, by taking away people's joy? Or
yeah, absolutely. It's for them. It's you know, it's because it's an ideology. You know, this is nothing to do with religion actually. So it's a basic ideology that way they can dictatorship. That way they can control people. That to enjoy yourself is a satanic thing. You know what I mean? So it's like, or you dress yourself as a girl or something like if you want to go out without any hijab or any veil, or you just want to dress up yourself a little bit shorter clothes to show your legs, or these are all considered satanic. Mm-hmm. You understand what I mean? So it's like, but it is just words they put into their actions. You know, it's like they try to convince people that it's about the religion, because nobody's religious in Iran. You ask me, and nobody. So this is the way they just. Through their religion and through their Islamic rules, they want to control. So this is how it works.
What was the turning point when your family decided to take you away from there at 13?
Oh, that was the big turning point, because I was, like I said, I was 13. I was in the school. I was going like fifth grade or something like that. Yeah. I remember one day, because the Iran-Iraq war was starting that time, or started it actually, and it was the second year. So they kind of, this IRGC, this guards of the Revolutionary Guards, came to the school and literally pointing out some kids of 13, 14 years old and signing them up to bring them to the war, to bring them to the front line. And what they were doing basically to throw all these young kids, boys, in the front line so they could get the mines exploded, so the military behind they could approach easily to. I went back home. I said to my dad and my parents, it's like we just had today these people lined us up in the guard outside in the yard in the guard behind the yard. And they were just signing us up, and he said, "There's no way you go to school tomorrow. We're gonna pack up everything." He suddenly started to activate the whole panic attack in a way. We have to sell everything. We have to get out of here right now. You don't go to school anymore. And they kind of got me out of there. We came as a refugee to Denmark, as a kind of a political refugees.
My God, I've got goosebumps. Just like,
and of course the journey from there, we started to run away from our country until Denmark. It took another 1.5 months on the way. You know,
I was going to say, what was that journey like? Tell me.
The road was long. The road was really. It was basically we could not fly anymore, and you know, the passports are not working anymore. And it was the middle of the war, so. And we had to take a bus from Tehran all the way to the border of Turkey. And the Turkey, we got somehow, I don't remember how we got in. I mean, somehow, I think they paid somebody. But anyway, we could smuggle us in to Turkey that time. And from Turkey, we ended up in Istanbul. From Istanbul, we had to wait to find out how we can get from Istanbul to Denmark. And the journey was not easy because it was not, you could not just take a flight to Denmark from there. You know, the passport doesn't work. So there was one way to get there. It was through Moscow, that time the Soviet Union era.
Oh, my God.
So we had to fly to Moscow, and 2 days in Moscow. After that, fly to the East Germany, Berlin, East Berlin. And that time, the East Berlin Wall was, I remember very clearly when we were driving from airport with taxi to the train station of East Berlin, driving along alongside this Berlin Wall. We came to the train station. From train station, we took a train to Denmark to Copenhagen.
Oh my God! I mean,
this was like I know. I mean, anybody here didn't say, "No, you're joking." It's like, but that was it. That was the only way we could get there.
Wow!
It took us months and a half. Is together, you know, and imagine the stress, the drama, the panic in my parents who were young, you know. Yeah, I can't imagine how this they could do it, but they did it. They bring me to Denmark and they saved my life.
My God, I'm feeling quite emotional. It's just like, yeah, what an amazing journey, and what incredible tenacity from your family to say, you're not going to stay here. And
literally, I mean, if I stayed there, they would have come pick me up, and they literally was throwing kids in. You know, if you read the articles in the history of this war, maybe thousands, like hundreds of thousands of kids just died, nothing, just like walking on the mines.
This is absolutely unbelievable. I have no idea. Wow.
The crimes this regime has done to people in Iran is unbelievable. And they have they dare to criticize the regime before that, which was absolutely nothing to do with all that. Read about it. No, it's a long, long, long story. That.
I'm going to after this. Just like I.
This has done huge damage to this country. I mean, so much. I mean, besides the war, besides that, all the killings, all the executions. I mean, it's like it's nonstop. It's never nonstop.
I mean, it's devastating to watch that from afar. I mean, obviously, it first came fully to my attention, I suppose, with the Women, Life, Freedom. You know, the Instagram.
That was just one episode. You know what I mean?
So much later down the line of all these other situations that I don't think, you know, people talk about so much until obviously, you know, it becomes like a massive Instagram campaign and people are chopping their hair off to support. And I mean, I was seeing murals painted around Delft Villa in Ibiza town of like, you know, women with their hair being chopped off, and people were, you know, really getting behind this movement. But as you said, you know, there's all these decades and decades and decades, if not more, that came before all of that when you were there. And that's just shocking.
From the beginning, it was from the beginning. I mean, it was, we have a data about how many protests and how many revolutions we have. It's almost every second year since 1979, because nobody wanted this. Nobody wanted this regime to come and take over. It was just it was literally a coup, a kind of a, they take over, you know. Mm-hmm. And with the help of course, the European and America at that time. So it's kind of a,
Talk to me about this journey. So you had 2 months on the road nearly with your parents of getting to Denmark. And when you arrived there, like, what was it like to try and find a place that you could call home and feel maybe at home as well?
Yeah, but when we came to Denmark, we got received there one of the first Iranian refugees, actually. They were taking refugees that time. They were asking for it, actually, to come there. You know, they wanted to help. For the first 6 months, of course, in the refugee camps, and you know, to get kind of installed in the country. After that, so started to, you know, they kind of put me in the school, and I had to start all over again from fifth grade, you know, one more time, or third time, I think I went to the fifth grade that year. It's like in those years. So yeah, I mean, you know, to learn the language and to come to the system and integrate. And we did it very well, actually, I have to say. We, you know, both my parents, they went to work. They had some, you know, simple jobs. And me and my sister went to school. I started school and went on from there.
Mm. How do you think that kind of shaped your sort of sense of identity, that whole transition and migration and, you know, that whole kind of sense of self growing up?
Yeah, it did a lot, of course. It was not easy in the beginning, of course, because you feel always as a foreigner, you feel always as an outsider in a foreign country with a foreign language. I was young enough to get into it quickly, and I got quickly some friends. And also, I had Danish friends from the beginning, you know, and I didn't have, luckily my parents, they are very open-minded people. So they're like, you know, they got us from the beginning out of the cities and out of this, and just in the countryside, growing up with the local people, you know what I mean? And this helps a lot, because from the beginning, you get into the system with those people, like Danish people, you know. You don't have the chance to have your own little ghetto somewhere, which that normally happens most. That's when everything goes wrong, in my opinion. If you import immigrants from somewhere, try to dispatch them in different locations, out of the cities, out of the ghettos.
Yeah.
Let them get integrated properly into that country.
Mm.
At least have a chance to do it, you know.
For sure. Yeah. No, it makes all the difference. And it's so important to, you know, integrate locally and understand the culture and get to grips with, you know, the way life is there. And that can't happen when you're surrounding yourself with people from the same place and space. When did you leave Denmark? What age did you stay there until?
Yeah, I was there until 2003-04. I was running a club down there in Copenhagen with my very close partners. And this club, like 4 years, 5 years, and we happened to kind of end it in 2004. I think it was the beginning of 2004, and I started to feel like I need to get away from here. I need to kind of move on. You know what I mean? I had pretty much a lot of success in Copenhagen musically and DJ wise, and kind of like, okay, now I need to, you know, go further. And it happens that some of my very, very close friends, Danish friends, they moved to Ibiza that time, like a year before that. And they were asking me always, "Ah, you have to come here, you have to come here." So I came over to Ibiza and to visit them on the New Year's Eve of 2004 in January. And I played a little party and we had a lot of fun. And I stayed for 2 weeks on the island. I say, wow, this is it. I found my place. I went back and I basically packed all my stuff.
When did you start making music in Denmark?
It started pretty much from 90s. 90. I started DJing from 90s, like in 1990, basically, and making music properly, like really. I was always doing some music, but really got into it properly in 93, 94. I got my first release more like in 98, I would say. Yeah, that's one of my first releases. Yeah.
You know, what was that journey like to actually start producing your own music? Like, where did you even begin?
I was learning. You know, I was learning. I was experimenting with machines. That time it was like, and I got my computer almost like in the mid 90s, and started to experiment with the computer. So everything really took time to kind of learn. It was really, that's why the releases came much more later, because I was confident enough to make something out of what I was learning. Yeah, it was a different time. Of course, it was absolutely a different time. Everything was analog. Everything was machine. Everything was cables and connections everywhere. You know, it was not like today. Like, you know, after all these years, of course, I always had different studios, different setups and everything. But I came to the point now. It's like, you know, I just want to have a home studio, simple things, computer is enough, and just good sound, good processing things, and that would make my job.
Incredible. I mean, what a journey to, you know, to get to that point. And how did you, you know, start to teach? Were you self-taught in terms of the production?
Yeah, I mean, through some friends, they knew how to do it, and through them. But I was so fanatically into it, so it was like, you know, it was not a day or night I would not sit somewhere with those machines and try to figure out how to get a rhythm out of this, you know what I mean? So yeah, it's in the beginning, it's really, it's, you are so, I remember I was like really into it, like a crazy guy. That's the only way you can really get something out of your hobby. It was a hobby, but it was, in a way, it became my kind of a job also. Mm. So I haven't done really, I mean, I didn't work all my life almost now, but I remember since 30 something years, I'm just producing and mostly DJing. I mean, DJing and producing. So I haven't had any other job.
Good for you.
It's not always easy, I have to say. No. I mean, I have to be honest with it. It's not always easy. It's ups and downs. But yeah, I've been lucky enough to live out of it. Mm. And, hopefully, I can still continue that, because I don't know what else to do. The experience of working is so skills in that point.
What kind of equipment or kit were you working with at the beginning?
I mean, equipment was always synthesizers. Like, I had my first Roland synthesizer. It was a Roland D20, because I saw on MTV that time Depeche Mode had it. So I was like in the beginning of Depeche Mode, actually. And I was just like, I need to have that. I have a synthesizer in my possession. So my parents, actually, that time, it was like, I think I was like 16 or something, birthday.
Your parents sound like complete legends. Like, I really want to meet them.
But they are amazing. Yeah, they are really, really amazing, amazing guys. Because they got me when they were young, you know, and they were both of them party people, musicians. I mean. So yeah, they were kind of us today.
Yeah. Where do they live? Are they still alive?
Yeah. They live in Copenhagen. They like Ibiza. They really love the island.
And so you got the Roland, and then basically from there you started to experiment with production.
I got the Roland. I got some. I got another one. It's like it's groove box with the drums and everything. It's called the Groove Box 303. I got that one a little bit later. So I just compiled slowly some small machines, you know, and expanded my kind of studio machinery.
Incredible.
Yeah.
And so you've made quite a lot of albums, or mostly EPs, or?
No, mostly EPs, singles, you know, like, because I got really quickly into dance music, you know, and mostly dance music for dance floors. I mean, the style was always like a deep house, tribal house that time. And then I slowly started, actually, my first label I started in 99 under the name called Black Powder. Recently, actually, some other digital platform, they came after me and said, could we please re-sign or I would just say re-release those ones in digital because they're only on vinyl, which I don't think that was that good. I mean, it was okay. But, you never know. Some other people listen to it and say, wow, it's something really different.
Amazing. So I need to research Black Powder then when I get off this call.
Yeah, Black Powder. I mean, if you go to Discogs, you can find them all. Another similar name was called Manijama. Manijama was like together with the two other guys. And we had our release. I did a cover version of Sean Penn, which is called No, No, No. You know, No, No, No.
Yeah.
You don't love me. Yeah. We did a cover version of this and we released it on Defected Records.
Wow.
I had to go to London and I had to sign with Simon Dunmore in the Defected Records office in London. And it was a very exciting time as well.
What happened with that? How did it go?
Yeah, it went, I think, well, because we got paid a pretty nice awesome sum.
Excellent.
Advance money. Yeah. I think it went well. Yeah, it was a quite big release on Defected that time. It was played a lot in Ibiza at that time.
Wait down and tell the people about the musical dish coming your way.
No, no. This is this is a big, exciting, I think, precursor to your big summer in Ibiza. You're going to be playing at the Ray of Light Awards. How did you get involved with the Ray of Light? Talk to us about the event.
Ray of Light is because I know Beta and Ray. I mean, I met Ray and Beta in under the COVID time. It was in the 2020, actually, I think, through a friend, one of our common friends. And at that time, we were we met each other through walking together. Basically, there was no other things to do under COVID. So we decided to meet every day, every second day in Salinas and just walk and walk together like a group.
Yeah.
It was like, it was me, Ray, it was a friend, Tandy, it was another friend, Sergio, and sometimes we were a bigger group, sometimes we were a smaller group. Sometimes it was only me and Ray just going for long, long walks, like the 10, maybe something kilometers.
Mm.
You know, Salinas is a huge place to walk. And that's how we got really, basically, we got to know each other very well, and through all the talkings and walkings. And some few parties together, I mean, here and there. So, yeah, I know them very, we got very close, very, very dear friends until Ray passed away, unfortunately. That was kind of very sad for me. Yeah, that's how Beta basically wanted me to be part of this, of course.
Mm.
It's a natural thing, so you have to be part of it.
For sure. How would you describe that friendship as it kind of evolved with Ray through walking and meeting? And I guess that's probably the most intimate conversation you can have with someone.
Yeah, very intimate. And for many cases, very intimate. And for a lot of cases, a lot of experiences. Good. I mean, for me, it was like very exciting to hear his stories, I mean, Ray has a lot of stories from his career and filmmakings and movies. And I could always find some similarities, towards what I'm doing and my travelings. And because I've been traveling like all over the world for what I'm doing. DJing, we could always be kind of related to each other through that in different ways. I miss those talks, and I do that. I mean, I was really, as for me, like a bigger brother, in a way. I was loving listening to him, his advices.
What was the best piece of advice he gave you?
Oh, many things, but I mean, a lot of things, a lot of times it's like you have to go on and be, you know, believe in yourself. And, you know, you're a big guy and you're, you know, you have to just do what you have to do, you know, and believe in it. Even on down times, you know, when I was a little bit down, you know, I didn't have enough gigs, enough, you know, difficult times. That's like, you know, you're gonna jump into it. You're gonna do it because you know how to do it. You proved it already to everyone. You can do it. So he was like that kind of person who was always boosting you. Mm. This is something. It's incredible. I mean, not everybody can do that. You know.
Mm. It's true.
He was that kind of person that feels like his energy was like taking over suddenly, and you could feel it, you know. It's like in front of him, you could not let yourself down in any way. And, you know, it's quite powerful.
Beautiful. In terms of the fatherhood, obviously you've got two kids and he's got three, and, you know, the beginning of the festival is dedicated to a day of fatherhood. And is that, you know, is that something that you also maybe connected over?
Yeah, nice. He was a great father, absolutely. I mean, I saw many times with his sons coming with us walking, and the attention and the you know, the attention that he was paying to his kids, and talking to them and talking to them as equal adults in a way. And,
yeah. I'm very sad to say I never get to meet him, but I'm very, very excited to see everything that they've got planned and to see you DJing at the after party of the Ray of Light Awards. And there's still tickets available if people want to head to rayoflight.com. And thank you so much for taking some time out of your day in Geneva to join us over the ether of the connection. It's really lovely to hear your story and to meet you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Likewise.
It's the Reset Rebel. It's the Reset Rebel. It's the Reset Rebel. Coming to you every day.
Welcome back.